You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News, 2025 was an exciting year for many reasons. Never mind the growing trade dispute south of the border, the explosive federal election in the spring, new megaprojects announced in the region, and the growing housing and drug crisis, to name a few. Northwest BC has seen its spotlight over this past year, and today we're going to dig into some of the most memorable stories of the year. So stick around, don't touch that dial. We launch our annual year in review right now on CICK News, 93.9 FM Smithers Community Radio. First up today, we go back to April 2025 and take a quick look at the Shoesboomer Downhill Recreational Race up on Hudson Bay Mountain. We were on the scene for all the action. Take a listen. The Shoesboomer Downhill Ski Race is one of the last community recreational ski races in Canada. This past weekend, the Shoesboomer marked 39 years, almost 40, and it was one of the biggest yet. Hundreds of racers from across the Bulkley Valley and beyond donned costumes and sleek, skin-tight racing suits, all vying to be the fastest skier on the hill. I had the pleasure of digging into the sights and sounds of the 39th annual Shoesboomer on the famous Twinkle Toes Run on the north side of Hudson Bay Mountain. It's a pretty windy morning here on Hudson Bay Mountain's north side. We're at the top of Twinkle Toes, a very long run, very fast run today. There's fences up and gates as racers are all clamoring around, getting into position, getting focused and ready to go to rip down the hill and hit their time. I see a number of faces here, young and old, but everyone seems to be getting their skis prepped and standing in line waiting for their turn. The forerunners, as they call them, are just about to hit the slope, to hit this run and see how fast they can go. There is rumor that some people might break 120 kilometers an hour down this run, but we'll see what happens. Right now, I'm going to chat with a longtime ski racer and one of the members of the Smithers Ski Club.
Phil Bernier.
Phil, how are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling fantastic, yeah.
Nice. How many Shoesboomers is this for you?
Oh, I think this is probably like my 12th Shoesboomer. Yeah.
I hear you're the winner from last year, the reigning champ.
Defending champ, yeah, that's right.
Okay. What does one have to do to win the Shoesboomer?
Stay loose and go fast.
Yeah. What kind of gear are you using? Because looking around, you know, I see some old skis, old long skis.
Oh yeah, lots of old skis floating around here. Everybody's got their downhill suits and the fast wax, so yeah.
I guess, what do you love about this thing? You know, this is, Shoesboomer is almost 40 years old, something like that. You know, it's one of the longest running community ski races in Canada. What do you love about it?
It's just such a good environment. Everybody's coming up the hill, having a good time. They got their teams. And yeah, 39 years of consecutive Shoesboomers is pretty cool history.
What goes into making sure that this gets off without a hitch? There's lots of people who are lining up right now. Dave says he needs to focus. What do you need to do to kind of be in the zone?
Well, there's lots that go into prepping the course, putting up B-nets and all the safety and making sure all the timing's ready to go. And then, yeah, when it comes to race day, you just want to focus, keep your head down, and make sure you don't make any mistakes.
One of the other things is, you know, there's a lot of youngsters here too. And I know, you know, part of the the organizing team is a Smithers Ski and Snowboard. You know, what does it mean to have a lot of the youngsters kind of doing this? What does it do to help them kind of evolve in their skill as a skier and snowboarder?
It's super important. All of us are alumni of the ski club, and now we're all parents, and we got kids, and kids are looking at us, seeing that we're having a good time, and looking towards doing the same thing.
All right, good luck today.
Yeah, man, thanks.
Jess Hall.
Jess Hall?
Yeah.
And Jess, it looks like you're performing some sort of operation on your ski. What are you doing here?
So we're brushing them, we're putting a little extra juice, we call it, you know, just to help us out in the first flat section here when it's a little bit wet like this.
Yeah. Yeah, the snow is pretty soft and squishy. So what do you got to kind of do? What's kind of rule of thumb to make sure that you're getting up to speed?
Well, good start is always good. Good push. The more you can get out of the start fast, the better you're going to be on the flats.
Yeah.
I hear that these are trade secrets a lot of the time, what people are putting on their skis.
You bet. It's basically whatever we can find in our cupboard from, like, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, whatever's left. Yeah.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you.
This is fun.
Yeah. This is from back in our racing
something
days.
You're going to want to do?
Yeah.
How old are these skis?
Well, old, as you can see, right?
Yeah.
But the older they are, the faster they get.
Totally.
Yeah.
They're so thick. Oh, man.
One of the main organizers of this big event, of the Shoes Boomer, is the Smithers Ski Club. It's also Hudson Bay Mountain in general. This is a community event, so lots of people involved. But right now we're going to chat with one of the main organizers who's been doing this for quite some time.
I'm Cormac Ickish. I'm the president of the Smithers Ski and Snowboard Club. And here helping out with the 39th Shoes Boomer downhill.
Awesome, Cormac. Cormac, how many Shoes Boomers is this for you now?
That's a really good question. I would estimate between 15 and 20 Shoes Boomers I've now done. Yeah.
What's the Shoes Boomer all about? Because it's one of the longest running, if not the longest running, community ski race in Canada.
Yeah, it's one of the only masters-oriented downhill race in the country. There's only two in British Columbia, and I don't know about the rest of the country. It's been around for almost 40 years. It started in 1984, actually. By a generation above me, and it's an incredible event. We have over 100 athletes every year. People bring out their longest, fastest skis that they can find from their ski tickle trunks, or they rummage from friends, and we've also got lots of serious younger athletes competing as well, because it's open to our club members here and from afar. And so we get lots of locals that come. Some in costumes, many in costumes, old gear like I'm wearing, but others wear costumes. And people come from all around BC now. We've got friends here from Williams Lake, from Prince George. We've got people down in the Okanagan and Vancouver talking about coming next year for the 40th annual. So it's a great event.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always struck by a lot of the gear. Obviously it's old, but it looks fresh. You know, it's been kept well. What do you love about the Shoes Boomer? Because there, you know, there is an eclectic crew of you know, folks like yourself that have been doing this for a long time, that are, you know, got the need for speed, some long skis, but we also have a lot of youngsters here that are also part of the ski club. So what do you love about the Shoes Boomer coming back every year?
Well, I love the camaraderie. Everyone's having so much fun, and there's a, even though it's ferociously competitive, there's a lot of sharing of information and intel and, you know, trading ideas back and forth. And even though some of this gear looks quite old, if you look at us going out of the start, it's actually fairly modern stuff. The skis have been made perfect to perfection. Some are new, some are old. The base of a ski, you just don't know if they're fast until you've tried it a few times. But as you know, young and old, we all help each other out. We have a lot of fun. It's all about how fast were you at the finish, how much fun did you have. And then another thing I really like about it, in the afternoon is the race run. So the fastest people, it's only that one run in the afternoon that counts. Nobody knows their results until later on in the evening. And so there's a precious few hours where we all don't know. We're all equal. And we're all just talking about how great it was and how wonderful it was. And then awards, there's cheers and rahs, there's surprises and tears, and it's just all the emotions. It's a great, great day.
No doubt. You know, right now, every year is a little bit different. Some years I've been up here, quite a few years I've been up here, and it's been, you know, very little visibility. Today it's pretty nice, but the snow is pretty sticky and soft. What do you gotta do to your skis to make sure in this kind of condition that you're gonna hit that spot?
Well, mass equals momentum, so the heavier you are, the better, which doesn't help me. There's only so much I can do there, but definitely tucking is important, so your aerodynamics, longer skis is better, and then you know, what goes on your bases is a bit of a trade secrets. There's definitely some really interesting stuff going on those bases. Some of it's fairly pricey. People put some money into this program because they want to be on that podium.
No doubt.
But you'll have to ask others for those trade secrets.
Yeah, I know. I'll leave them be secrets.
Yeah.
Just the last thing for you, Cormac. You know, one of the things is counting the speed, you know, gauging the speed. How fast are people going here? Like, at the top of the list, how fast are we talking about?
Well, I just came from the bottom. I was clocked at 113 kilometers an hour. And then the two fastest guys were 116. We might crack 120 kilometers an hour here today.
Oh, wow.
And some of these younger kids are going over 100. That was their goal, to break 100. And we had two younger girls in their teens. They were both 101 and 109, I think.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, there's some fast speeds down there.
No doubt.
It's safe. There's netting. We give them lots of training, but it's a lot of fun. It's a fast race.
We're coming up on 40 years here. You mentioned the 39th Schussboomer. Where do we go from here? What's the future hold for the Schussboomer here on Hudson Bay Mountain?
Well, I think there's a lot of things we're going to keep. I think next year we're going to get a bigger turnout, so we're already talking about what that looks like. So stay tuned for some more interesting swag. Everyone walks away with something, so some real storytelling. And I think we're going to get a lot of people come from other parts of the province to race next year at the 40th.
Awesome.
It's going to be fun.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Cormac. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks. That was great.
That was our review back in April 2025 of the Schussboomer Recreational Downhill Ski Race. Keep your eyes open for the 40th anniversary of the Schussboomer coming up in 2026. Up next, we take a quick look back at the federal election 2025 right here in the riding of Skeena-Buckley Valley. We did see some action and a flip of seats. The Conservatives' Ellis Ross took over for the NDP's Taylor Bacharach. We had a chance to catch up with Ellis Ross during the campaign election when he stopped off here in Smithers.
How's it going so far?
Good. We're getting good responses here in Telqua and Smithers and Houston and Burns Lake. Yeah, but it's a massive riding. We're trying to get to everybody.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a struggle getting out to every place.
What are you hearing from people? What do you think the big issues are?
Places like here in Smithers, they're worried about the crime. I mean, especially the other day, I just got word that a challenged person got home invaded and beaten up and had to crawl for help.
In Smithers?
Yeah, in Smithers. And everywhere I go, even the smaller communities like Telqua, they're worried about the crime. And I came from Terrace, and I brought the Terrace Council down to Victoria to try help the British Columbia government to realize you got to come help these towns that are trying to struggle with a crime, which they did.
Are you hearing about tariffs?
What's that?
Are you hearing about tariffs?
Oh, yeah. Everybody's hearing about tariffs.
What are your thoughts on addressing that?
It's something that the United States is doing to bolster their own economy. And I agree with something that Poilievre said a few years ago, we're too dependent on the United States. I think people realize that for a long time. So I agree with Poilievre, we've got to diversify our trade with other countries. But first we've got to apologize to them because we sent Germany away with saying, we don't have LNG for you. We sent Italy away saying, we don't have LNG for you. I mean, our government said there's no business case for LNG. But now Alaska is going to sign a $40 billion LNG agreement with Japan. And so without a doubt, there's a business case. In fact, we got LNG started first in Kitimat, but the United States started later, and they became the largest LNG exporter in the world. It's just that our economy has been stifled and ignored for too long, and now we're finding ourselves in a weaker position.
We have the third largest port in Canada in Prince Rupert.
Yeah.
How do you think, in this context, how do you think we here in the Northwest can position ourselves in this trade war, tariff war, with a place like Prince Rupert?
They are key. I went to tour it there. I've seen all the land they cleared out, and they lowered the grade like 20 feet. And they're talking about exports, imports. And they've actually got the rail actually built into it around their site. It's massive what they're doing. I think that Prince Rupert is key, especially when you consider Vancouver Port is backed up. All the West Coast ports are backed up. The only question I have is, okay, we have an undeveloped port in Stewart. I think that could be key for mineral exports, as well as we have a private port in Kitimat, but that's already basically earmarked for LNG and Haisa Cedar LNG. But we have, I've been talking about economics for 15 years. I've been talking about interest trade for 15 years. Nobody wanted to listen. Now everybody's concerned about the economy that's been stifled for 9 years and how do we fix it. It's a great conversation to be part of finally. And this is what I'm going around telling communities, especially ones suffering, like Houston. I mean, it's time to reinvest and think big and bring back our economies for the sake of our societies and our people who are suffering.
One thing you brought up the other day, April 1st, we're going to see a tanker of LNG come up the channel to kind of prime the system there at LNG Canada.
So yeah.
LNG Canada is getting ready to ship out their first shipment of LNG before the end of this year.
That's right.
So that's happening. Where do you sit with the Tsai Lisms LNG port that is proposed and kind of going through the motions right now? And on the same note, with, you know, with this type of issue with tariffs and diversifying economies, would you support a repeal of the tanker ban?
The tanker ban won't affect them because that was mainly set for oil tankers.
Yeah.
But Tsai Lisms LNG is in the same boat that we were in, Haisla, back in 2004. I mean, this is what people don't realize. It was the Haisla people and First Nations from Prince George to Kitimat that actually pushed LNG exports on the provincial government and federal government. I mean, it wasn't the provincial government's idea. It wasn't the federal government's idea. In fact, we had to convince them this was the way to go. And so Niska is in the same boat right now, and I fully support them, not only in terms of what it's going to do to get their people a better lifestyle and a better future, but also how it's going to benefit Canada and BC. And the tremendous amount of work and opportunity that we provided in Kitimat for all the communities across BC, I think that's what LNG for Niska is actually proposing, the same thing.
I know you were chief counselor of the Haisla back in the days of the Northern Gateway debate. And obviously, subsequently happened was that tanker ban C-48. And yeah, you know, it doesn't cover LNG, so LNG is on its way. But would you support repealing that tanker ban to, you know, open the door for oil export out of the North Coast?
Well, I thought about that in the context of what was happening at the time. And when they came up with that tanker ban, the two First Nations opposed it was Lac aux Lambs and Niska, because they felt they hadn't been consulted and accommodated. And this is what I find with these types of governments, when they talk about this stuff, they don't really pay attention to the First Nations that really want economic development to resolve poverty or unemployment. They just go with, well, what seems right for Ottawa or Victoria for that matter. And that's what I've been trying to change. I've been trying to tell different levels of government and politicians, First Nations are actually mandated to have a seat at the table because of the Haida court case of 2004. And what I find is, more often than not, governments ignore that. And that's what I try to fix. I try to educate politicians, governments, to kind of stick to what government's supposed to be doing on behalf of all of us as Canadians.
I mean, on the same note, there was a lot of support from First Nations and others around the tanker ban. What would you say to that?
There was, but you know what? When you go back to the Haida court case of 2004, I mean, I know it's a kind of a tough question, but there is a clause in the Haida court case that says you have to look at the economic component of rights and title. You have to look at it. And when they came up that tanker ban, they didn't consider the treaty rights of Niska, and they didn't consider the Aboriginal rights and title of Lac aux Lambs. They didn't consider it. And First Nation leaders, the ones I've met over the last 15 years, they're all trying to do one thing. They're trying to lift their people out of poverty. And for politicians and governments to ignore that is actually ignoring what has been referred to as Canada's shame. I mean, hopefully we resolve that in Kitimat, and hopefully we resolve that as a first step for pipeline communities along the route from Prince George to Kitimat. But, you know, most of the Aboriginal leaders that I met, they're doing it for their people, for a better future. Kids, grandkids, seven generations down the line.
Is it fair to say then that, you know, oil transportation through the riding wouldn't be off the table as far as you're concerned?
No, I've been watching the conversation, and it's not a simple answer. There's a lot of aboriginal rights entitled to be addressed as per Section 35 of the Constitution and the Haida Court case. I don't agree with Carney saying that he'd invoke emergency powers to build pipelines. You don't need that. All you got to do is reverse Ottawa's policies. And if you do invoke emergency powers, what does that say about you railroading over Aboriginal rights and title? He hasn't answered that question.
Okay. Because there's that recent letter from a handful of oil companies that were suggesting that. Is that what you're thinking of?
No. I'm just thinking about, like my background is protecting the environment back in 2003, 2004. And then it started protecting Aboriginal rights and title interests as per the Haida Court case. Yeah. So when I see governments overreaching and trying to power grab, saying that it's an emergency somehow, I've seen that before. And coming from the Indian Act, I try to warn people, when you give away a bit of your rights to government, be careful. Because once they take a little bit, they'll start taking more. So that's what I'm trying to warn people about that. Because under the Indian Act, everybody will tell you, it's about government control. And that's what a lot of First Nations have been trying to fight against, getting government control out of their communities. So I'm very, very nervous when I see governments claiming that they're going to do something and using emergency powers when really it's not an emergency. It's just reverse the policies that you put in place that stifled our economy. That's all you got to do.
Thanks, Alice.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Good luck.
You too.
That was the Conservative candidate for the riding of Skeena-Bulkley Valley, Ellis Ross. Coming up next on our 2025 review of CICK News, we take a quick look at a global story that had a local impact. After years of war in Gaza, the outcry from the public has been growing, and here in Smithers, it was no different. CICK News was on the ground for a rally and march back in June in support of civilians in Palestine. As the Israeli war intensifies in the Middle East with attacks on Iran and retaliatory missile strikes in Israel, many in opposition to the expanding war want to ensure that the growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza doesn't get forgotten. Over the weekend, thousands of people from around the world came together in marches and rallies to show their solidarity with those suffering in Gaza, even here in this small part of the world. Carmen Wojak is a member of the Smithers Palestine Solidarity Group, which gathered together to mark the Global March for Gaza along Main Street in Smithers.
My name is Carmen Wojak. I'm associated with the Smithers Palestine Solidarity Group. It's a group that started up in January of this year when Heather McPherson came out and we had a meeting and discussion with her. And then after that, the group was formed. That was led by Bronwyn Hobson. She kind of started it. And today we had a march down Main Street in solidarity with the Global March for Gaza. That's happening across the globe, and a march for free Palestine.
Why did you want to take this on? And obviously there's been, you know, more events that you have organized in the last while to bring more attention to what's going on in Gaza. Why are you wanting to bring attention to this here in our little old kind of corner of the world here in Smithers?
I feel like it's an incredibly important thing to bring light to. We have so much in common in terms of the genocide that Canada perpetrated against the Indigenous people, the colonization of this land, and also Palestinians are human, and it's an absolute travesty what is happening with the genocide going on in Gaza, the relentless violence and bombing, the starving of 2 million people, and not just Gaza, in the West Bank, and just the colonization of Palestine in general. I just feel like if you're human, it's a very human problem, and it's something that everyone should care about deeply.
Tell me a little about the march today. What did you guys do, and what did you talk about?
The march today was in solidarity with the Global March to Gaza. There, from the June 12th to the 20th, there's been global marches in different countries and in cities. It marks the Samud convoy, which is There's been thousands of activists and volunteers from Northern Africa, from Canada, from France and the Netherlands that have traveled to Cairo in an attempt to march to the Rafah border and break the siege and open up a humanitarian passage. And the second focus that I wanted to take in was that it's Father's Day. And for the past 18 months, we've been kind of talking about how tragic it is for the women and children that are being killed, that are suffering, that are starving. They're targets of Israel right now. But usually the men are dismissed or their suffering is ignored. And I just wanted to highlight that there's thousands of Palestinian men and fathers and husbands and sons that are also suffering. They're also starving with their children. They're the ones that we see in videos kind of digging through rubble, trying to search for survivors. They're the ones that are carrying, one or two more children on their backs as they run away from airstrikes, carrying people to safety. They're the ones that are right now being lured to aid distribution points and then are being gunned down, all in attempts to try and get what little food that they can to feed their starving families. And I just felt like it was really important to highlight them, especially after Palestinian men and Arab men have been demonized and brushed off as terrorists and everything else. So, yeah.
Obviously, in the last few days, we've seen an escalation in all this business. Looks like Israel and Iran are in a war now, firing missiles at each other. Again, here, there was talk of what action people can take. What are you hoping to come out of these marches and these actions? And what do you hope people take away from this? What action would you like to see them take and get the message out that this is not sitting well with Canadian citizens in large part, and this is not sitting well with other parts and other people, other citizens of the world?
The message I wanted to try and get out today is to not give up and to not forget Gaza, that Gaza and Palestine are still the focus of the story. And I feel like, Israel attacking Iran might be a desperate attempt to get the focus off of Gaza. And, if people are too busy watching what's happening between those two countries, that they're going to lose focus on Palestine. But I also think it's important because Israel right now is acting in such a way where it's breaking humanitarian laws, international laws, acting with such cruelty. I just feel that it's a threat to peace and justice, to humanity across the globe, as well as to our collective safety. And that it's not just Israel. Any state that wants to act in such a way is unacceptable and is immoral.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A longtime Smithers resident, Peter Rebergen, spent time in the Palestinian refugee camps and the West Bank. We spoke with him about his experience there and why he felt the need to march.
Peter Rebergen.
And Peter, I know you. We've spoken about this before. You've spent time in Palestine, now seeing the escalation, but also, as you mentioned, seeing this type of action, even in a small context. How does it make you feel to be here today?
Well, very conflicted. On the one part, it gives me some encouragement and some hope to think there are still folks who think about humanity and what it could be and should be, and also still quite upset and discouraged at how much pain and horror there is in the world and why we can't get our act together more quickly, more effectively. And so I'm particularly concerned about doublespeak, where we say nice things in print and verbally in our faith traditions and so forth, but then we are more than just reluctant in trying to follow through in that, mm-hmm. In ways that start to have a real impact. Yeah. So we're just really comfortable maintaining the status quo and not really moving things in a direction that is going to make some significant change in the futures of others who are really experiencing some of the horrors of whatever it is, poverty, apartheid, all those injustices.
One thing that was mentioned was, wanting for people to take action, to make people feel empowered. What kind of action do you think is needed from, you know, people who've attended today?
Well, there are many different ways to do that, and we can all make various responses, whatever might work. I appreciate those who are able to participate in a march that draws some public attention to this, and hopefully, you know, a response of interest and saying, I'd like to know more, understand more. Why do you do these marches and so? So that's one thing we can do is education, awareness, and I always encourage young people too. And I think as an educator, while a grade 12 diploma, university degree doesn't mean that you've done your education. A big part of education is getting out there and actually experiencing, whether it's mountains and lakes, or the difficulties of refugees in various places. War-torn countries are going through. So it's those experiences that, in my case, have been life-changing. I had the opportunity to experience some of that. So, yeah, it's going to affect us all if we take it seriously. Everything from go out there and feel it to, my own comfortable lifestyle. I might have to make some adjustments there so that there's a little more justice for others.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Finally on the program, rounding out our coverage in 2025, Northwest BC was on the docket in Ottawa once again for announcements around major projects, national building projects, as Prime Minister Mark Carney called them. Prime Minister Carney was in Calgary back in November to sign a memorandum of understanding with Alberta Premier Danielle Smith in the hopes of building an oil pipeline to British Columbia's west coast. However, Coastal First Nations as well as the government of BC have already signaled their strong opposition to any sort of oil project to BC's north coast and to ensure the long-term protection of the sensitive north coast. Here's that story coming right up. Last week, Prime Minister Mark Carney was in Calgary to sign a historic memorandum of understanding with Alberta's Premier Danielle Smith, which outlines a new energy pact, which, among other developments, would see a path forward to develop a new bitumen oil pipeline to the northern coast of British Columbia. Although some have applauded the move, many have criticized it as a political stunt. As Ottawa and Alberta try to contain the fallout, First Nations conservation groups and even the government of BC have already voiced their opposition to the plan and vowing that an oil pipeline and port through some of the most remote regions of the country will never be built. Since the agreement on November 27th, former Federal Environment Minister Stephen Gilboa has resigned from cabinet in protest of the new agreement. The reception for Premier Smith signing the MOU was met with boos at her United Conservative Party conference over the weekend, and political pundits are criticizing the pact as just political antics that has done little to appease Liberal MPs in British Columbia and Premier Smith's far-right base in Alberta. As rumors swirled before the signing of the MOU last week, Coastal First Nations, the Premier of BC, David Eby, and the Haisla Nation have all voiced their opposition. Earlier this month, the CFN, including several non-member nations and the government of BC, signed the North Coast Protection Declaration. BC Environment Minister and North Coast MLA Tamara Davidson had this to say about the government's opposition and insisted that they will never support oil transportation on the north coast of BC. Here are some of the remarks from several First Nations along the North Coast, as well as Environment Minister for BC Tamara Davidson and Premier David Eby, and what they had to say about BC First Nations and communities' opposition to oil transportation on the North Coast.
My Haida name is Lawness. My English name is Tamara Davidson. and I'm so honored to be here today as the Minister of Environment and Parks. For millennia, Indigenous people have been stewards of the water, land, wildlife, and rich resources at the heart of what we now call British Columbia. I continue to renew my own love and connection to the land that often fills me with wonder. We have been stewards of our own lands and waters for time immemorial. To talk more about the importance of BC's coast, I'm pleased to welcome Premier David Eby.
Thanks, Samara. Good morning, everybody. It's great to see you here early this morning. We're joined by a number of our friends from Coastal First Nations. Behind me, I see a number of my colleagues from the legislature here this morning. It's great to see you, colleagues. All of us are gathered here for the same reason. It's to celebrate the amazing and incredible northern coast of British Columbia. This is a coastline, if you've never had the opportunity to visit, I really encourage you to do so. It is a gem for the entire nation. It is a signature landscape and oceanscape that people think of when they think of British Columbia and when they think of our country as a whole. And not only is it beautiful and wild and incredible, but what often gets lost in the conversation about the North Coast is the incredible economic driver that it is for communities up and down its length. Whether you're talking about larger communities like Prince Rupert or smaller communities like Bella Bella, Bella Coola, tourism, fisheries, industries that have developed in a sustainable way along the coast through careful planning and work by multiple levels of government, now reflect thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in economic activity every year. Now, if you've had a chance to visit a place like Cape Scott or one of the Bellas, Bella Cooler, Bella Bella, it might feel a little crass to talk about economic activity in what is such a special and magical place. But it's important that we talk about it because that is the conversation that's happening right now across the country. How do we grow and strengthen our economy? How do we stand up on our own two feet as Canadians? How do we advance an economy that is distinctly and uniquely Canadian? And I can't think of a better example than the work that we've done in the Great Bear Rainforest. Here's a situation where we invested $60 million as a provincial government and now see $1.8 billion in economic activity, that we're continuing with our commitments around the Great Bear Sea project. When you think about salmon, when you think about the fish, the seafood, the tourism opportunities, you can see how these numbers add up so quickly. It means that whether you're strictly focused on the numbers or whether for you nature is paramount, we can all agree that protecting our coast is not a threat to the Canadian economy. It is, in fact, a strategy for the Canadian economy. The oil tanker ban off the coast of British Columbia has been in place for generations, for more than 50 years. This is a consensus that has lasted across multiple governments. When it was encoded into law recently, that was not a new thing. That was putting into Canada's legal code something that had been the practice for decades. This oil tanker exclusion zone recognizes the obvious, that one crude oil spill would destroy billions of dollars in economic activity, would destroy the livelihoods of thousands of people and families up and down the coast. And there is no technology, there is no ability to clean up that spill. So when we think about what we have, the incredible gift as British Columbians and Canadians that the North Coast represents, both economically and just as a symbol of who we are as Canadian people, and you think about the opportunities still to come We've only gotten started in terms of the opportunities along the North Coast. Putting it at risk to get rid of the oil tanker ban makes absolutely no sense, either economically or for the country. I also want to be clear about something. Coastal First Nations are standing with us here today. Continue to be the drivers of economic activity in British Columbia and for the country as a whole. We may not always agree on everything, but one thing we do agree is that the oil tanker ban enables us to do major economic work together. It is not a surprise to me that 40% of the major projects in the federal government's shovel-ready major projects office right now are located in BC's Northwest. We require the ability to cooperate and work together and navigate responsible economic growth that benefits everybody and sustains livelihoods that have existed since time immemorial. We're going to be signing a declaration today calling on the federal government to stand up against those voices who would have us walk away from this multi-generational commitment. This is not, in my opinion, a partisan issue. Conservative leaders like Brian Mulroney, Ronald Reagan, they recognize that some places were too precious to put at risk. And that includes our North Coast. So we call on the federal government to recognize what generations of leaders have, that we need to protect our coast in order to grow our economy. And the conversation that we can have as a country between each other, the provinces and the territories, can be that distinctly Canadian approach of protecting the things that are precious for future generations while growing the economy, creating opportunity for many people to come. And it's the people behind me, and it's the people of British Columbia and Canada who will make that happen. So thank you very much for joining us here this morning. I stand here, it's an honor to stand here with the Coastal First Nations and recognize your leadership in standing up for the tanker ban that has existed for decades, may it exist for many more decades, and we will all push together to ensure that that opportunity is preserved for generations to come.
My name is Kawajit Marilyn Sletz, and I'm the president of Coastal First Nations and also the elected chief counselor for Halsik Nation. And Coastal First Nations is an alliance of coastal communities from the North, Central, and Haida Gwaii. And today we're joined with our leadership from our communities. We're also supported by the First Nations Leadership Council. We want to acknowledge FNLC for their support and also acknowledge the beautiful territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, and allowing us to do this important work here today on their traditional territories. And I want to welcome all of you for being here today. When people think about beautiful British Columbia, they think about our coast. They think about our territories, our people, and our culture. They think about the whales and the salmon and the spirit bears that live here. Our nations have stewarded and cared for this area, our home, for 14,000 years. And it remains one of the richest and most productive ecoregions on Earth. Reflecting on the words of a Halsik elder who also provided testimony at the 1977 West Coast Oil Ports Inquiry that was held in Namu, Angus Campbell said, "An oil spill would finish us. We want to continue to live our way of life connected to a healthy, intact ocean. We will never stop fighting to preserve our cultural and our spiritual way of life and the coastal wildlife and ecosystems that we depend on." That is why we are here today with the province of British Columbia to call on the federal government to commit to upholding the Oil Tanker Moratorium Act to protect our ecosystems and to grow our coastal economy for the benefit of all British Columbians and for all Canadians from coast to coast to coast. The oil tanker ban is a result of 50 years of advocacy by our coastal communities, and it is foundational for keeping our coast healthy and our economy strong. For the past 25 years, Coastal First Nations Great Bear Initiative has been focused on building a sustainable conservation economy. This economy was built in partnership with the province and federal governments, and it has been incredibly successful. New data provided by Coast Funds confirms that in 16 years, the conservation economy fueled by the Great Bear Rainforest Agreements has created over 1,000 permanent jobs and over 100 new businesses, all while protecting the environment. Building on our success, just last June, we signed the Great Bear Sea Project Finance for Permanence Agreements with the federal and provincial governments, which has the potential to triple these numbers. But we can only realize these benefits if we keep our coasts healthy and productive. This is what we're focused on, and this is what we want to keep building on our coast. That is why today we are proud to stand with the province of British Columbia, united in our shared responsibility to protect Canada's north coast. We stand together in calling upon the Government of Canada to uphold and defend the oil tanker moratorium.
I'd now like to introduce and welcome to the podium Gary Reese, the Mayor of Loch Alamos.
I come from a community that is one of the largest communities in BC. We have over 4,200 members in our band. You know, we're already rich with all our sea resources that we have in our area. We have salmon, all the sea resources. My people still go out today to get those sea resources and the salmon. Our fishermen go out every year for our people. We have a fish plant in our community. We spent millions to upgrade that to a ground fish facility that employs up to 100 of our members every year. That is the largest employment we have in our community for our people. We want this tanker ban to stay in place. We cannot afford to let this happen to try to lift that tanker ban. We've seen what an oil spill can do up in Alaska. Today, they still have the effects of that spill. Another oil spill was in the Helsinki there when they had an oil spill, and we all see what that can do. That'll destroy all our sea resources that our people today depend on, and we cannot afford to let that happen. My people will never, ever agree to allow oil in our territory. We have lots going on in our territory. We're involved with a lot, but we sure don't need that oil, which can destroy everything in our territory. And I'm really happy to see all the First Nations and the province, the premier here today, supporting that to have that tanker ban stay in place. And we want to see it stay in place all the time, forever. We don't want to ever see that in our territory. And we will go against it all the time. So thank you with that.
And that's a wrap for us here at CICK News for 2025. Be sure to check out our archive to listen to all our stories from the past year. And be sure to tune in 2026 as we continue our coverage here in Northwest BC on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. right here on 93.9 FM Smithers Community Radio. Thanks for listening.
Learn more about CICK. Visit us at smithersradio.com. Yeah, .com.